You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimena toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Hello, welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 22nd of March. I'm your host today, Shimena, and of course, as always, my producer Adam is joining me in the studio. Today on the show, we examine the comments made by a National Party representative to bring back corporal punishment in schools, and if the style of discipline does more harm than good. We're talking to AUT's Alan Blackman for Dear Science. This week, we look at a new way methamphetamine is being smuggled into New Zealand, and also how scientists have just replicated the infamous Milgram experiment, where a shockingly high number of participants were found willing to electrocute an innocent person. We're also talking about the OECD's latest report on New Zealand's environmental performance, which gave us a fail grade, especially in relation to our greenhouse gas emissions. And finally, we talk about Songbroker, a new web application which helps connect musicians with those wanting to license their music. If you want to get in touch with what we're talking about today, as always, 5395 is the number to text, or 309 3879 is the number to call.
The Wire.
But first, we speak to investigative reporter Nicky Hager about his new book released last night called Hit and Run. It's co-authored by John Stevenson, a prominent war reporter, and makes the case that 21 civilians, including a three-year-old girl, were killed or injured during a revenge raid in Afghanistan by the SAS in 2010. I now have Nicky live on the phone. To start, Nicky, can you give me a quick rundown of what actually happened during the raid and who was involved?
Yes, hello. I'm happy to do that. This was a strange time for New Zealand. New Zealand had been getting on very well in Afghanistan. Compared to most countries, we'd had troops there, no one had died. We'd been in a relatively peaceful area. And then the first New Zealander died when the roadside bomb went off. And the job was given to the SAS of tracking down the people who were responsible for it, the SAS who were based in another part of Afghanistan in those years. What happens is that there was a mood, according to the people, to the SAS people and the people we talked to around them, there was a mood of rage and indignation that a New Zealander had got hurt. And they tracked down a group of insurgents who they believed were responsible, and they unwisely jumped to the conclusion that those people were based in these two little isolated villages in the middle of the mountains there, where alas they were not actually located, because insurgents in Afghanistan for decades have followed a procedure of hiding in the mountains after an attack because they don't want reprisals. And so our SAS got asked for support from US helicopter gunships and drones, and loaded piles of their own SAS commandos into helicopters and headed off these two small Afghan villages and did this ghastly attack where there were no insurgents there at all. There were children running frightened, and their parents and old people. And it was just a terrible tragedy that what turned out, which could have been a mistake, but it was fueled, and you could just say it was a mistake, except first of all, it was fueled by this anger, and they went around blowing up and burning down houses as well. But secondly, they never admitted they'd done anything wrong. They gave no help to the wounded. They never went back to give any help to the people afterwards even, and they've tried to cover the whole thing up.
And so how do we know it was New Zealand forces that actually killed and injured these people?
What we know is that quite a lot of the deaths were caused by bringing in these helicopter gunships, which are like intergalactic, incredibly powerful murdering machines, and using them in an urban area where there were people and children and people running between houses and things. So the New Zealanders led the raid, they commanded the whole thing, they were in charge and responsible for what happened, and they used helicopter gunships in there, which was inevitably, unfortunately, going to end up with civilian casualties. On top of that, we've looked at it as closely as we can. We know each person who died and where they died and things. And there were two people who died who didn't have helicopter weapons. They had bullets, which had small holes going in and big holes coming out, just name the horrible facts of it. And it seems quite possible that they were SAS snipers. So then if New Zealanders were involved because they organised it and asked for it and took these helicopter gunships into those villages, and they also may have been directly involved through the SAS snipers, And also, they were, as I said, they were blowing up and burning down houses as they went.
And so in terms of who to hold accountable for this, is it purely just the SAS, or does it go further up the chain than that?
Part of it that we're really... Accountability is always hard to judge exactly, because you don't know exactly what people knew. The first round is the SAS are undoubtedly most culpable for this. And I think a lot of the cover-up and the secrecy has come from them as well. So primarily it's the SAS. But actually, the SAS were very careful. Well, before they did this raid, they knew it was big and they knew it was risky. And so the night before the raid, they briefed the Defence Minister and the Chief of Defence Force, who were in Kabul. And we've had exact details from people who were at the meeting of what went on there when they briefed them. And even then, the Chief of Defence Force and the Minister of Defence thought that maybe this was too risky, and they didn't want it to be on their hands either because of what was going on. So they stepped outside their room, and there, outside the operations centre of the SAS, they rang through to John Key and briefed him on what was happening, and he made the decision. So the ultimate decision to do this went right up to John Key, and he gave them the go-ahead to go ahead with it. So there's a number of different levels of accountability and responsibility.
And so who did you speak to get a full picture of what happened during the raid, and how do we know that their accounts of what happened are reliable?
To answer the second question first, when you do something like this, we can't quote the SAS people we spoke to. We can't quote the intelligence people. How do people believe it? Well, the reason you write a book is we packed it with detail of who was where and what happened and the order of things and exactly showing on maps what happened where. And if we're fantasists and criminals and we just made it up, well, that's one thing. But otherwise, it gets an internal credibility because we've got so many sources and we know so much detail. Because as I say, people can't front. They'd lose their jobs. They'd be in big trouble if they were to be revealed. Who helped us? There were members of the SAS. There were people who were on the ground in the raid. There were people who were supporting the raid. And there were people who heard about it afterwards and who were involved in different ways. And, of course, there were the villagers who we had extensive contact with. And so, because it was such a large and complex and then hidden, covered-up thing, we had to get lots of different sources in different places, which is why it was a two-year project to do this, and gradually cross-reference their information and decide which bits of the memory seemed to be correct and which bits were corroborated by other people, and built the story around it.
And so after the launch last night, the New Zealand Defence Force came out and said that they stand by the statement they made in 2011, which says they'd investigated allegations that were made regarding civilian casualties during the operation, but that these claims were unfounded. Why did their investigation not match up with the findings of your investigation in this book?
You know, when they put out that statement again, which was a pack of lies in 2011, and they repeated it again. Now, I actually couldn't believe it. I think that there's a lack of good judgment amongst the people who made that, because anyone who looked at the book would know that it was not credible to say that. I'll just explain for the listeners. What they were saying was, what they said in 2011 when rumours of some sort of a raid reached Television New Zealand and they slapped it down and denied it all, they said two things. First of all, they said that they had killed 9 insurgents, like it was a big success, and secondly, that they had killed they had harmed no civilians. So those are the two facts that they say they're still sticking to, and yet they didn't kill any insurgents. We've got their names. We know every person they were looking for. We know what happened to them in the years afterwards. We know that they turned up to the funerals of the dead innocents, and they were filmed on a mobile phone by someone there, who later sold it to the New Zealand intelligence people. We know that they know for sure that they didn't get any of the insurgents they were looking for. And we also know from their own reports and from their own staff talking to us now that they know that they killed civilians. So to put out a statement which was completely opposite to the truth, I still don't know what the Defence Force is thinking.
And so what these are pretty serious assertions about the behaviour of the SAS, and from what do you believe that these could be grounds to suspect war crimes were actually committed?
That's correct. Now, neither John nor I, my co-author and I, we are not international lawyers. And so what we said in the book was very brief on this. We said that, our lawyers had dictated the words to us, that there were good grounds to suspect that there have been serious breaches of international law and war crimes. And what those are, that means that they're not taking seriously the difference between civilians and combatants. It meant, for example, that we haven't talked about is the beating up and torture of a prisoner, which is something that New Zealand soldiers know is wrong, and the blowing up of the, and burning of the houses. Those were the things which stood out there for us.
Mm. And so just finally, what are you hoping the next steps will be? How do you want the government to respond to this?
This is very important. Tell you what I really hope. I hope that we won't just get a silly, knee-jerk reaction saying, it's all lies. Those guys don't know what they're talking about. I hope that there'll be some mature people who will say, there's obviously something in this and we'd better look at it closely. And what I hope will happen is that when they start to dig into it, when they get their staff to read the book and realise that it is very well documented, that they'll see that for New Zealand's sake, they have to have a commission of inquiry, they have to dig into this, and they have to do the inquiry which should have happened the week after the raid when it first went wrong.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Nikki. I really look forward to having a thorough read of the book when I get my hands on a copy.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
So around, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was Nikki Hager speaking about a new book that was just released last night called Hit and Run, which is co-authored by John Stevenson and makes the case that 21 civilians, including a 3-year-old girl, were killed or injured during a revenge raid in Afghanistan by the SAS in 2010. Next up, my producer Adam will introduce the next story.
So, a National Party representative is calling for the return of corporal punishment in schools after a gang of teenagers wreaked havoc over the weekend in the small far north town of Kaikohe. The gang, which consisted of children as young as 11, robbed a liquor store and vandalised a petrol station. In response, the community are calling for a larger police presence in the area. But the chair of the National Party's Kaikohe branch, Alan Price, says the underlying reasons for such youth disobedience is down to a lack of physical discipline, even going as far to say it's a form of child abuse not to raise children with discipline. I spoke with Julia Ione, a clinical psychologist who specialises in the area of youth justice, child behaviour and youth mental health upon the subject, to really find out if there is any scientific backing to the calls for a return to physical discipline in the school system. Firstly, I asked if corporate punishment has any effect in curbing bad behaviour in children.
There's a reason why it was taken out probably about 30-odd years ago, and that was because we realised through a lot of evidence and through a lot of research that it doesn't actually work. What it does do is that it increases the risk of aggressive behaviour, it increases the risk of antisocial behaviour, and as most of us would know, or some of us would know, antisocial behaviour leads to a number of adverse outcomes for a lot of our young people that include, youth offending, that includes mental health, substance abuse and all of those sorts of things. But the short answer to that is no. I know that out there, it worked for me. There's that common argument, it worked for me and I turned out all right. It was around when I was in high school as well. When I was in primary school. And the reality is, it might have turned out okay for you, but to be able to generalise that, I think it's not okay. And the reality is that what corporal punishment actually does is it creates this facade that actually that you're using aggressive behaviour to get your point across. And that's and it's reinforcing the message to our young people, if I'm violent or if I become aggressive, then I'm going to get my point across, I'm going to get my needs met. We've got to be mindful of that as well. I think the key to all of this, with schools is that it's what's the key to getting these young people engaging in their education, and that's not just solely for education. It's a wider issue. It's a community issue where a lot of our different organisations, government, non-government organisations, as well as communities, iwi organisations, Pacific organisations, all need to come together.
You mentioned a few of the negative side effects that have come across from administering this type of punishment. Would you be able to explain a bit further how corporal punishment kind of reinforces bad behaviours rather than actually curbing it?
Well, if you think about what corporal punishment is, what's it actually doing? You're using force, to actually inflict pain, and the reason why you're doing that is because you're wanting to correct the inappropriate behaviour. And some will see that as, that's appropriate because that's a form of discipline, or actually it's a negative form of discipline because you're only doing what you're told because you want to avoid that situation or that unpleasant situation of getting hurt or that force that's being inflicted on you. You know, and that's my issue that I have with corporal punishment, is that we're trying to teach our young people that violence is not the answer, and yet we're actually, by you know, using things such as the strap or the cane that used to be around in my day, you know, we're actually sending a mixed message that that's okay to do. And it's actually not. You know, so we're wanting to talk about discipline. Discipline is about guiding a young person, you know, their moral values, their development, as well as their physical development, so that when they get older, they're able to make good decisions and be able to understand why they're making those decisions. It's about teaching them boundaries so that they're aware of the values, of their values, their actions, and the impact that it will have on others.
When corporal punishment was a widespread form of punishment, did we actually see any reduction in youth delinquency whatsoever?
I think what we have to be mindful of is that youth offending right now has decreased, you know, and that's something to be mindful of. And we can look at past years, there's been an increase in youth offending, and currently at the moment we see a decrease. I think what we need to be looking at for these young people is what's actually driving their behaviour, what's driving these children or these young people to do the things that they're actually doing. So rather than looking at the behaviour on its own, it's to be able to look at what are the underlying factors to that behaviour.
Generally, what underlying factors do we find which causes this type of behaviour?
It's a number of issues. I mean, when I'm working clinically with these children and young people that are either working with, that are either involved in the youth court system or at risk of becoming involved in the youth court system, you know, it could be family factors, it can be issues within the family that can be related to exposure to family violence or experiencing violence. It can be things such as parental criminality or parental substance abuse. It could be issues with mental health. It could be issues in terms of their education, some cognitive difficulties, or some learning language competency issues. You know, it's not just a one-size-fits-all, and there's no silver bullet, you know, to be able to respond to these issues. That's why it's complex and it's challenging. Working together as a community, and that is drawing on all the resources that we have to come up with a solution that's not going to be short-term but long-term for these young people. I get the reason that what you're wanting them to do is to stop offending, and also you're wanting them to have positive life outcomes as they become adults and as they become parents.
What you're suggesting is that the antisocial behaviour which we're actually seeing in Kaikohe doesn't actually stem from a lack of discipline, but rather from multiple factors surrounding it?
Yeah, and it could be that as well, but I would say it's not the only thing. You know, and I think we have to be really mindful of too. We have to be careful not to make that assumption that because these children or these young people are doing what they're doing, then it's because, you know, that they've got that corporal punishment will work for them, because it won't. If you think about it, if you're a child or a young person that's been exposed to violence, that's experienced violence, whether it be at the home or whether it be at any other environment, corporal punishment at school is not going to work, because it's something that, unfortunately, you know, they're either used to or they've been exposed to. And I see that in my line of work when I'm working with these children or young people. It's like violence will breed violence. And if they've come from those homes, you know, whatever you do to them is not going to be, or if they've come from that environment or that community, whatever you do to them is not going to match up to what they've experienced. And so, therefore, it's about changing our approach, changing awareness of what they would expect, because they would expect people to, you know, provide them with punishing consequences. That would be the norm, their expectation. But it's about teaching them in a nurtured environment, teaching them, praising them when they've done good behaviours, praising them when they've, you know, made the decision not to go down the not-so-good pathway, and being able to put in boundaries around them. And that does take time. It's not something that will happen overnight.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was Julia Ione, a clinical psychologist, responding to calls for a return to physical discipline in the school system. We'll be back with Dear Science after this.
In the beginning, there was lakes. Songs were made and ideas formed. Then enter the Magic Band, a group of lost musicians destined by fate to intertwine their prowess, charisma, X Factor and mystique into an unforgettable supergroup. And so it comes to pass. The album release for Lakes and the Magic Band. March 24 at Rec, 28 Custom Street, East Downtown. Tickets available from rec-akl.nz.
Bro, there's this guy, man.
What's this guy's name?
Oh, he's in a band.
A band?
Yeah, man, he's play guitar.
He play guitar? Like, you know, the A and the G and the B and the...
Yeah, and he plays this finger stuff. The blue scale.
Oh, he fancy with it.
Fancy with
he
it.
Fancy
the
with
blue
it.
Scale, eh?
Yeah.
Fancy.
NZ On Air Music presents Fancy New Band. We have trawled the nation's dive bars and bedrooms so that every Friday on Morning Glory, we can bring live and direct to your ears a fresh as musical revelation. Fancy New Band, every Friday on Morning Glory on Radio B.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, indeed, it's time for Dear Science. AUT's Alan Blackman joins us again live in the studio. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm doing good, Shamina.
That is awesome. So first up today, we're talking about how police said last week that they've uncovered a new way that methamphetamine is being smuggled into New Zealand. Can you tell me a bit more about this?
Okay, so as you say, last week four guys were in court and they were charged with importing not methamphetamine, but a thing called TBOC methamphetamine into the country. So how this all worked, apparently the stuff was packaged up as being laundry powder, washing powder or something, or washing liquid, and it came in on a boat from China in January, and customs went over it, and they found that something was dissolved in the liquid, and this stuff that was dissolved in the liquid was a thing called TBOC methamphetamine. So, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, there are tests for methamphetamine, specific tests. So if customs finds a white powder or whatever in a package, they can do a very quick test and see if this stuff is methamphetamine or not. What people are now doing is masking the methamphetamine. So you've still got the methamphetamine molecule in there, but what you do, as you know, what chemists do, is that they basically add a little bit of another molecule to methamphetamine, and they stick it on a nitrogen atom in the methamphetamine. And what that does then is that it renders the tests, the specific tests for methamphetamine, pretty useless, okay? So this stuff will then pass those tests, and then it comes into the country, they give it to their chemists, and it's a very, very simple thing to do to take this other molecule off the methamphetamine, and then you make pure methamphetamine again.
So it just goes back to what it was.
Yeah. And this is anybody who's done any university chemistry will know this sort of stuff. It's a very, very common procedure when you're making molecules. You have to put some bits on at some stage in a synthesis and then take them off later to stop the thing reacting in the wrong way. And so these chemists in China, which is where this came from, so obviously this is the way that they're doing things now in an attempt to get past all of the stringent tests at the border. And this is the first time that this has been found in New Zealand, so this TBOC methamphetamine. But what has happened previously was in Australia last year, they found a very similar TBOC ecstasy. And again, they found that in something that was labeled as something else. They got a bit suspicious and analyzed it and found that, yes, this is what it was. And again, you know, they can easily treat this with the chemists. All you've got to do is just a little bit of acid and it falls off and you get ecstasy out of it. And so there was a paper published in an academic journal that I just read last year by these Australians who were involved in doing this. And surprisingly, in the paper, they said, you know, this is the first time we've seen this sort of thing done with ecstasy. Possibly it could be done with other drugs like methamphetamine. Surprise, surprise.
Right.
now they've gone and done it. So obviously, now that the authorities know that it's out there, a test will be developed for this stuff as well. But as with so many things with drugs, it's a matter of the authorities being one step behind the chemists.
Right, yeah, I was going to say that. It's kind of a race to kind of try to build something that doesn't pop up in the tests, right? I mean, it's the same with drugs and sport, from what I understand.
Yes,
that people are developing drugs that then don't show in the tests, and then people, you know, authorities are constantly trying to catch up.
Yes, yep. And of course, this has got legal ramifications as well, because what then is classed as an illegal drug? We know that methamphetamine P is an illegal drug. Is TBOC methamphetamine covered in the legislation? And obviously, if it's not, then it's going to have to be. Presumably it is. I imagine, I haven't read the legislation, but I presume that it's wide enough that they can encompass any sort of close derivative of methamphetamine. But, it really is. I hate to say it's a losing battle, but it's a very, very tough one.
Right, yeah, exactly. You kind of can't foresee what's going to happen. You kind of, it has to be a reactionary thing.
Of course, yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. It's always reactionary, you know, unless you ban everything.
Right, yeah. People would not be too happy with that.
No, indeed not, no.
And so moving on to our next topic for today, a new paper published tries to clarify a debate around reaching the lowest possible temperature. Can you talk me through this?
Okay, so there's a little thing called the third law of thermodynamics. There are, in fact, four laws of thermodynamics. As I always tell my first year classes, the first law of thermodynamics, the second law of thermodynamics, the third law of thermodynamics, and...
the fourth law?
No, see, you fell into my trap. It's the there's a thing called the zeroth law.
Okay.
Believe it or not, okay, because they got the first and second and third laws first, and then they realised it didn't make any sense without having something before them, so they made up the zeroth law.
I see.
There you go, trivia for the day, folks. Didn't you just need
like,
to know that?
Shit, what are we doing? Zero. That makes sense.
Okay, so there's the third law of thermodynamics, and basically what that says is that you can't reach absolute zero. So absolute zero is the coldest possible temperature. We had a wee chat about this, I think, a month or so ago on this very show. And this was a law that was proposed on the basis of some experimental evidence and some theory as well, but it's never been proven. And this law was developed or proposed, I guess, in 1912, around about 1912, by a guy called Walter Nernst, who, in addition to winning the Nobel Prize, was born exactly 100 years to the day before me, so I feel a kinship to
it's your birthday that you share. It's pretty special.
So I bet he never knew that. So he said that you can't reach absolute zero in a finite number of steps, and that's the way that you cool things down. You cool things down in steps. When you get to very, very, very low temperatures, you've got to cool them down in steps. And Nernst said it would take an infinite number of steps to get to absolute zero. And that's a proposal, but it's never been proved. And so last week there was a paper appeared in Nature Communications, that very, very good journal. A couple of guys at University College London came out with essentially a mathematical proof saying that, no, he's absolutely right, you can't do it in a finite number of steps. The reason being, as I understand it, it's pretty complicated stuff, is that there's a limit to how fast you can cool things, okay? And if there's a limit to how fast you can cool things and you need a whole heap of steps to get to absolute zero, then you're never going to get there. You're going to do it in increments, boom, 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 boom. Each of them are going to take a particular time, and so therefore you can't actually get there in a finite number of steps. That's essentially the guts of it. But it is kind of nice. It's the first time it's been proved, and, you know, it's purely academic. But, you know, it's not purely academic, because it's got implications in things called quantum computers, which are going to be the next generation of computers that are going to be infinitely more powerful than anything that we've got today. And as the name suggests, they use quantum effects to operate, and these quantum effects are very, 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 very subtle. They're easily disturbed, and so therefore these computers, if and when they come into being, you're going to have to operate them at extremely low temperatures. When we're talking extremely low temperatures, we're talking temperatures approaching absolute zero, negative 273 degrees Celsius. And so that's where all of this has some applicability.
Right. This kind of has a direct implication for, like, almost a direct commercial implication for the creation of, I don't know, future technology.
Yeah. I'm sure that's the way they'll spin it in the grand applications. Yep.
This is why this is important, because money.
Absolutely.
And so lastly, a lot of us have probably heard of the infamous Milgram experiment, which scientists have now managed to replicate. Can you remind listeners about what this experiment is?
Most certainly. Now, every year the film festival rolls around, and every year I never get to as many movies as I want to. And last year there was a movie called Experimenter. I don't know if either of you guys saw that.
No, I didn't.
And this was a movie actually about the Milgram experiment. And for those of you who don't know, so in 1961, Guy Stanley Milgram, who was at Yale University, did an experiment where he was looking at obedience and essentially how far people would go to obey people in authority, essentially. So the way that he did this was that he recruited people off the street, and he told them that they were going to be involved in a psychology study about memory. And there were three people involved in the experiment. There was the scientist, there was Milgram himself, there was a teacher, a so-called teacher, and a so-called learner, okay? And the teacher were the people off the street, okay?
Mm.
And so the teacher and the learner sat in separate rooms, And what the teacher had to do was, over an intercom thing, he had to read out a series of pairs of words, and then the learner would supposedly remember them, and then the guy would or lady would read out the first word, and then the other person in the booth would have to repeat the second word, so he'd have to match those pairs. Now, if they got it wrong, the teacher was told to give them an electric shock by pressing a button, okay? And so beforehand, they were shown all the setup and everything. They were shown the learner being strapped into this thing that looked like an electric chair, apparently, and, you know, electrodes applied and all of that sort of stuff. Mm. And then they went back into separate rooms, couldn't see each other, and then the experiment started. Now, every time, as I said, the learner got something wrong, the teacher was told to press a button and that would give them an electric shock. And the electric shocks went up in 15-volt increments and until they reached about 450 volts. And so the actual experiment was to see how far people would go in pressing this button. Now, obviously, every time they pressed the button, they could hear the person in the booth
screaming.
Because
I was going to say, like, they could hear them, right? Yes, like, that was all part of it. That it was an actor,
yes,
you know, making these sound effects.
Absolutely.
And as they were getting electrocuted, or, you know, supposedly electrocuted.
Yep.
So, which is, I don't know, pretty uncomfortable.
And some of the actors were told to tell the guys that they had a heart condition, you know, just to make
it
even worse.
Just to mix it up a little bit more. Oh, man.
And so they kept on getting them wrong, and they kept on pressing the button, and they'd hear these screams. And they'd turn around to Milgram and say, oh, look, you know, we can't go on. And Milgram would keep on telling them, look, the experiment depends on you keeping going.
That's right,
absolutely vital. You can't stop now. Please keep going. The experiment depends on it. And so these people kept on going all the way up to 450 volts, pressing the button. Now, before the experiment, the hypothesis was that perhaps about 3% of people would go all the way to 450 volts. And in fact, it was 65% of people did it. And that was, you know, basically showing that people will bow to authority and basically do what they're told, or the majority of people certainly will. And, of course, you know, 1961 wasn't that far after the Second World War, and we had a lot of people saying in that they were only following orders, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, this
that's
was
right. People
a display
sort of extrapolated it to, you know,
indeed,
make
yes.
sense of things like
yes.
that.
Yeah. And so that was the guts of the whole experiment, and that made him a sort of a very famous man in the world of psychology. And so this experiment has been replicated around the world, and very, very recently this has been published again, another experiment. This was done in Poland this time. And so the results were a frightening 90% of the participants went all the way to 450 volts
so
this time.
Significantly higher than what it was the first time round.
And, yeah, I'm sure people will be thinking of reasons for that. You know, Poland was a communist country for a long time, and they were, you know, used to obeying orders, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe that has something to do with it, but I'm sure it'll keep the psychologists busy for a while, these results. But, you know, absolutely horrifying experiment, but,
totally.
But you know, a very, very interesting insight into the state of humanity.
For sure. I mean, is it about obedience, though, or is it about, you know, if you're there and there's this very official-looking person in a lab coat...
Yes.
That seems like they have control over things.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it is. I don't know. Well, just because it's a safe thing, you know, you think like, okay, well, if this person says it's okay, then
it's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. And that's the important part of it, I imagine, is the whole authoritarian figure. You know,
right.
It's so somebody who supposedly has knowledge and seems to know what they're
right.
doing.
Yeah, for sure. That it's just like, okay, I trust this person. This person is legitimate.
Yeah.
Therefore, I'm going to do this thing.
Yes, yeah.
Right. So, scary.
Very, very interesting stuff
for
in the psychology world. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you once again for joining us this week, Alan. We'll see you again next week.
My pleasure. See ya.
That was Dear Science.
Paint It Gold and Niche present Bonobo, live in Auckland. Ninja Tune artist Simon Green, aka Bonobo, has been touring the world with the music from his masterful magisterial sixth album, Migration. Now, his place firmly cemented in the very highest echelons of electronic music and indeed beyond, Bonobo touches down with his full live band at the Auckland Town Hall, Thursday, July 27, with very special guest Romare. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
It's going off. You coming in?
No, my board needs to charge up.
What? It's the new solar-powered one I bought from that co-working startup that crowdfunded the tech cooperative.
They were just punk kids from Newland Heights.
Bro, I'll come out when the sun's out, okay? Surfing's moved on, okay? This is now. This is where it's at. It's like Uber, but for surfing. And move, your shadow's blocking the solar panels.
Those are just shiny black stickers.
Happy.
The 95BFM Surf Report, proudly sponsored by P2 Power. Sign up for peer-to-peer power at p2power.co.nz.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
Yes, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Next up, the OECD released a report yesterday which looked at the environmental performance of New Zealand. The report provides independent assessments of countries' progress in achieving environmental policy goals, as well as making policy recommendations. The report warns that New Zealand's high environmental quality of life is under threat from a lack of long-term planning. The country's growth is starting to show environmental limits, including increased greenhouse gas emissions, freshwater contamination, and threats to biodiversity. 95BFM reporter Hannah Ross spoke to freshwater scientist at the University of Otago, Mark Schallenberg, about the findings of the report.
Quite a long and thorough report looking at environmental performance in New Zealand, put out by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is an international organization with 35 countries involved, mainly sort of the European, English and European countries that have a fairly high standard of living and similar perspectives on the economy and the environment and society. So every 10 years they put out a report which looks at environmental performance of the different countries in the OECD. And this was the report which covers the period from 2007 to 2017.
And I guess what were the main findings of this report?
There's some really, I think, some important messages for New Zealand and its environmental performance. We're doing some things quite well. We have some fairly innovative approaches that we're trialing in some areas, but there's also some areas where the report really points a finger and says that we have much more work to do. For example, our per capita environmental footprint, so the amount of energy and resources that a New Zealander uses is amongst the highest in the world. And so we really need to, I guess, constrain our use of resources, I think, is what one of the main messages of the report.
And the report kind of saw that our environment was under threat because of not enough long-term planning. How do you think we can go about producing a more long-term plan to reduce our environmental footprint?
Yeah, I mean, I guess long-term planning is important, but I think for me what the report really pointed out was that there wasn't really much cohesion in terms of planning for the different sectors of the environment. So we have a ministry for the environment where we look at water quality, water quantity, and then we have a forestry regulatory body within MPI, and then we have development and transport, which are under different government ministries and units. And so there doesn't seem to be any sort of cohesion or coherent in terms of, I guess, sustainable development amongst all these different government policies and different government areas of regulation. So the thing that was pointed out in the report was that there needs to be kind of an overall strategy that brings all these different regulatory bodies into alignment, so you don't have crazy things like, say, one ministry doing something which actually contradicts what another ministry is trying to do. And there were examples of that given around the government funding irrigation projects, which irrigation leads to more intensification of farming, which can lead to more pollution going into water bodies. So at the same time that the government's giving money for cleanup funds for lakes and rivers, it's also encouraging irrigation, which is, you know, has real potential to make the pollution problems worse. So a kind of overall strategy that looked at sustainable development across government departments was something that the report recommended.
That was University of Otago freshwater scientist Mark Schallenberg speaking to 95BFM reporter Hannah Ross about the findings of the OECD report. Hannah then spoke to Chief Executive of Forest and Bird, Kevin Haig, about the report and how the government needs to go about reducing our environmental footprint.
The first thing that I want to draw attention to in the report, which I think is completely new from the OECD, is identification that the way that our economy works at the moment, it is already bumping up against environmental limits. In other words, around fresh water or greenhouse gas emissions, for example, you know, we're at the limit of what the environment can sustain, and we would argue over the limit. So what the OECD is saying is that for the New Zealand economy to continue to grow, we need to fundamentally change the nature of the economy so that growth can occur without being linked to increased resource use. So that requires really a major rethink of the economy. I think you know, we would agree with OECD's findings. In fact, the report is great. You know, we agree with pretty well 95% of the recommendations that are in it. And I mean, one of the things that OECD focuses on is greenhouse gas emissions, where New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions are increasing. Although in the OECD, on average, they have decreased. They're starting into a phase of decreasing. So we're going in the wrong direction. So we're one of the absolute laggards around the world. I think New Zealanders maybe don't realise that unless they've travelled significantly around the world, that we're not a leader, we're not even a fast follower, we're actually one of the slow coaches right at the very back of the bus. And so the OECD says that agriculture has to be brought into the emissions trading scheme, says that we have to tackle transport emissions as well through things like incentives for electric vehicles, getting the rubbish old polluting cars off the roads, properly taxing diesel fuel, road pricing to actually create incentives for people to actually get out of private cars and into public transport. A whole bunch of messages, in fact, that, you know, I think will be pretty resonant for every environmentalist. And the OECD also reports on the crisis in biodiversity. You know, that I think, you know, people probably assume that I'm exaggerating when I use a word like crisis, but we have literally thousands of species that are heading towards extinction, and only a few handful that are going in the right direction. I think New Zealanders really have no clue about that, so it's great to see the OECD highlight that point also.
And what are kind of the main acts that the government can do to protect the country's water and our native species and climate, and kind of stop favouring the short-term private interests over the environment? Mental footprint that we are kind of putting into our country?
Well, I mean, the report identifies, for example, on greenhouse gases, that we have made these commitments in Paris to sort of longer-term goals, 2030, 2050, but there isn't currently any strategy for achieving those goals. So OECD is saying we need to have a strategy. I'm saying, Forest and Bird is saying, it would be great if that strategy is supported by all of the parties in Parliament, which is something that the UK has been able to do. So actually make a policy change that's going to be effective in the long run, you kind of need to have policy that will be durable through, you know, quite a number of government changes. And that means you need to get all of the political parties together. Now, that's starting to happen on climate change, which is very encouraging. So it's a question of make that go faster. And we need to use the same kind of approach in other areas, on water, for example. OECD are big fans of using pricing to create signals. And so they're saying, for example, that New Zealand absolutely needs to introduce a resource rent, or effectively a charge for using fresh water for commercial purposes. And that applies obviously to something like water bottling, which has been in the news recently, but equally to, you know, dairy farming, where large amounts of water are taken, or anything that uses irrigation, but also, you know, making beer. You know, anything that uses water relies on the cleanliness of fresh water, should be paying for the use of that resource, and that revenue can be used to actually help clean things up. So it'd be great to see some cross-party consensuses emerging on right across the range of environmental and conservation issues.
And how do you think we should go about kind of reducing our environmental footprint? Do you think it is just a government-based problem and they need to start working together and creating a more environmentally friendly country? Or do you think it is kind of a lot to do with the individuals as well? We need to start not using cars as much. We need to start reducing our water usage. What kind of acts do you think need to be happening to reduce our environmental footprint?
Well, I think, you know, change can happen and leadership for change can happen at multiple levels. So there are, you know, there definitely are things that individual people can do. I'm always trying to buy responsibly locally sourced products, do my recycling, walk and cycle wherever I can, take public transport where I can, all of those things. Those are all important. Individually, they make relatively little impact, but collectively they make a bigger impact, and they make a bigger impact still if people who are making those choices themselves then extend their thinking to demand change from political leaders. Because while everyone can do something and working together is crucial, the pivotal role, the signal, the leadership that happens at a national level has to come from government itself. So we need to, with an election coming up this year, one of the most important things that people can do is recognise that we do have a conservation crisis on our hands. That the way that we've got the economy structured at the moment is being paid for by nature and by future generations, and vote accordingly, and vote for parties that actually make commitments to properly fund conservation, to actually do the kinds of policy changes that are necessary to have a more environmentally sustainable economy.
Around, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was Chief Executive of Forest and Bird, Kevin Haig, speaking about the new OECD report, which looked at the environmental performance of New Zealand. And lastly on the show today, local musicians can rejoice. New Zealand independent music publisher Songbroker is launching a new web platform tonight, which aims to represent Kiwi music to international users. The platform will allow those looking to license music for television, movies and other projects more easily reach overseas audiences. My producer Adam spoke with Songbroker's founder, Janhel Regal, about the reasons for developing such a web application and what benefits she hopes to bring to the musical community. He started by asking her to explain what exactly Songbroker is.
Songbroker acts as a publisher, so what that means is that we look for opportunities for people's songs. So we try and put them onto films, TV shows, online content, anything else that needs music. You can't actually just throw someone's music onto your project. You do actually need a license for it. So that's where we come in. We help out there.
Why did you feel it was necessary for you to create Songbroker in the first place?
Because I was sitting on a whole bunch of music that I've produced over the years, and I was working in publishing, and I thought, wow, the only way to get this music out there is actually to be with a whole bunch of other people. So what we try to do with Songbroker, what we're doing with Songbroker, is that we are creating a place where music people that produce things can find music all in one place. We've put a whole lot of music in one area so you can do searches on it. And the other thing about Songbroker is it's very easy to clear. And if anyone works in supervision or project management, they'll understand when I say easy to clear is a really the magic word, because music can get very, very complicated.
So what do you mean by easy to clear? Would you be able to explain that a bit?
Easy to clear means that we're a one-stop shop. So if you want to clear your music through us, we can do it all there and then. We can clear the master recording as well as the musical works side. So that means it's all done and dusted with one phone call or one email. It's a long time to actually figure out how to do it, to be honest, but yeah, it's really useful to have all the rights in one place.
How did the initial development of Songster go? Were there any hiccups along the way? Have you found it to be an easy process in developing the application?
It's taken me quite a few years, actually, to figure out the business model. It was a bit like a puzzle all the way along. So we haven't had any problems. We've just had to sort of just figure out how to make it work as a, as a successful and operating business.
Who is Songbroker most directed at? Is it the artists who are putting music upon your platform? Is it those who are looking for music to use, like you were saying, in videos and films?
Well, it's both, really. There's a lot of artists that don't really understand the business, and we help them there. We advocate for them. Like, we can basically negotiate terms for them and make sure that they're looked after. I mean, it's a really important part of Songbroker, is that we actually look after our artists and ensure their music is represented well and that they are looked after as artists. But at the same time, we have, you know, we're building a client base, and that's people that use music, so businesses and clients and production companies. And they're equally as important because they're the ones that, you know, support our artists' work by using it on their production and paying a fee to use it. So it's sort of, you know, it's basically everyone's really important in the whole scheme of things. So, yeah, but the artists, we feel that, you know, we're their publisher, so we're doing our best to make sure that they are published well.
I understand Songbroker is releasing tonight. Would you also be able to run us through the event and how people are able to attend?
Oh, well, it's really a big sort of celebration party because we're launching our global platform. And what that is, it's basically a big search engine that people from around the world can search our music, and, you know, if they want to license it, then they can contact us, and we can do that anywhere in the world. The interesting thing about music is that we can trade anywhere, and so we don't have any tariffs or border restrictions. We can do it all online. So, you know, when we say New Zealand is small, sure it is, but, you know, we live in a global community now with the internet. So Songbroker is about, you know, saying, well, actually, we've got a whole bunch of world-class quality music, and here it is, all easy to clear, and, yeah, let's go to the world.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that marks the end of another Wednesday show. Thank you to everybody who spoke with us for the pieces that we played today. It was Nikki Hager, Kevin Haig, Mark Schellenberg, Julia Ione, and Jan Halragel. Thank you also very much for Alan Blackman for coming in for Dear Science. And also thank you to my producer, Adam. We'll be back again next Wednesday with a ton more content, so tune in then. Next is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.